Taking charge of your future starts with taking the first steps. And saving up to $30 a month on Cox Internet with the Affordable Connectivity Program makes those steps easy to take. Whether they bring you to click upload on your first short film or join now for an online book club. Applying is easy. See if you qualify at cox.com/ACP. Non-transferable, one per household. Application and eligibility decisions are made by the FCC.
Rising Giants Network.
I hate to say it, but there's literally no hope for a better future now. And this is what it looks like because of everything happening this day.
I'm gonna love Beirut no matter what, even though I might leave soon, because there's no future, near future here.
You know, 1 year after the blast, I'm still very angry. And I need accountability. I need justice for what they did to us, to the Lebanese people. They should be thrown in jail and hanged.
Standing firm and continuing to oppose is one of the best ways that you can continue to be a thorn in the side of those who have gotten you to this point.
I'm Linda Tamim, and from the Rising Giants Network, this is the Beirut Blast. This podcast doesn't only recall the trauma lived by Beirut residents on August 4, 2020. It's also an opportunity to reflect on the year past, to mourn our loved ones, and to tell our story. And most importantly, never to forget. As a journalist working in Beirut, I was on the ground covering the events from the day of the explosion onwards. I witnessed destruction, trauma, and death. I've met with people who lost loved ones, whose homes were destroyed, and whose hopes and dreams were shattered. I spoke to many who, driven by desperation, were trying the impossible to leave Lebanon, whether by applying for immigration, by looking to work or study abroad, and even by embarking with their families on perilous journeys across the Mediterranean, trying to reach Cyprus illegally. The country has become hell on earth, they say. A jungle, a sinking ship. A place with no peace, a place with no safety or stability. A country with no future. Yet I also came across a few who are still holding on to the little bit of hope they have left in their heart. Hope that Lebanon is worth fighting for. Hope that someday they can finally build a country they will never have to escape. This is the story of August 4, 2020, told by the people of Beirut. People who came together and gave their all when they had nothing left. People abandoned by their government and left to survive the aftermath of one of the most powerful explosions in the world on their own. People I shared hugs and tears with. People whose strength I admire, whether they chose to leave or remain in the country. It's a story of loss, trauma, and survival. And it's also a call for justice, accountability, and closure. The content of this podcast can be pretty graphic and horrifying. There is no happy ending, yet at least. This podcast isn't for sensitive ears or for children. If it's starting to feel like too much, just switch it off. August 4, 2021, 6 a.m. I was running on just a few hours of sleep, but I couldn't stay in bed. Like many in Beirut, I was dreading that day. Actually, it was a mix of dread and anticipation, I guess, but I just wished I could erase August 4 from my calendar. Of course, I was called to cover the events of the day. Several marches and speeches were scheduled to commemorate the victims of the blast. Thousands of people from all across the country had braved the heat, parading through the streets of Beirut as they chanted anti-government slogans, holding pictures of those they lost, and applauding doctors, nurses, and Red Cross volunteers who had mobilized to treat the injured. The most emotional moment for me, and for many others I'm sure, was when we held a minute of silence at 6:07 p.m., the exact time the explosion happened. Sirens of ambulances and fire trucks had rung out in tribute to the firefighters and everyone who had lost their lives at that moment. I was standing atop a building facing the destroyed grain silo with a bunch of journalists who were also covering the event. As I was watching the scene, I thought how incredible it was that from the moment I woke up that morning, my mind managed to replay every single event I had lived on this day last year. and as 6 p.m. approached, I remembered how I looked at my computer, wondering what I was still doing at the studio. I remembered calling the cab, then exiting the building. I recalled every single detail, how I got into my Uber before we drove off, that pink reflection in the clouds. A shiver went down my spine. I looked at the silent crowd below me, pretty sure that each one present there was remembering details of their own story as well. A wave of intense emotions washed over me, and as I was capturing that minute of silence on Instagram, I couldn't hold back my tears. A year on and the pain is still here, although the degree varies from a person to another. Dr. George Kedem explained that while those who experienced the blast appear to have overcome symptoms of acute stress disorder, 10% are still dealing with severe PTSD and depression.
Having PTSD means that you are living the trauma every single day, means that you have severe symptoms every single day, meaning that you have symptoms that are affecting your day-to-day functioning. You cannot go to work, you cannot go to take care of your children, you cannot go to university, so on. So it's really affecting you on all aspects. And that's why PTSD has to be treated. And we're doing all our efforts to treat as much as possible, because if you do not treat PTSD, it will go on to become chronic. And once it becomes chronic, it's really very tough and very severe on people. People can become severely depressed. Some people become suicidal. Some people can become alcoholics in order to forget. So if you do not treat PTSD, it's a big problem. And we are doing that. So our clinics are still open. Our hotline is still open. Unfortunately, we are not seeing everyone from those 10%. Some people, a lot of people, are suffering in silence. And that's where our role has to continue, and the social media and every kind of media and the society at large is to really raise awareness about those issues. Even though it's been a year now, and even though maybe we moved on to worry about other things like, you know, not having gas, not having electricity, the financial collapse and so on. However, no one has moved on. What we know is that the brain does not forget, and all these experiences are in your brain. And God forbid the next trauma happens or something else happens, all these files will open again. And that's what happened, in fact, on August 4, a year ago. The reason why we had so many people affected by the blast is because a lot of us lived through the Civil War and lived through the bombings, lived through the Israeli war in 2006 and so on. So a lot of us did live through traumas, and these memories are very much engraved in our brain. And once you had this big blast, all the files opened again, and you know, we became very vulnerable. So even though now, quote unquote, some people have moved on, well, yes, they have moved on the surface. But if a new trauma happens, you know, no one moved on. You know, everything's going to be resurfaced again.
August 4, 2020 hasn't only left us with scars and trauma. Unanswered questions such as what caused the blast make it hard to have closure, especially for those who've lost loved ones. In the aftermath of the tragedy, politicians had vowed to launch a domestic investigation and give answers within 5 days. Yet here we are, a year on, still demanding those answers.
A year has passed. We didn't hear a single excuse. Not an explanation, not a report, not at least someone, a responsible person, to come and tell, we're sorry what you've been through. Not only they didn't say sorry, not only they didn't give us the reason what happened, not only they didn't give a report, they're not there.
We really did not feel any sense of accountability, and no one really came forefront and really explained what happened on that day, and no one really took action of, you know, taking anyone into custody. We all blame the government for what happened, because they knew that all these things were stored in that hangar, and no one really did anything about it. And that to me says a lot. There's literally no accountability. That's horrible.
You know, some of us are at the brink of going mad, right? You know, a year later, and yet, nothing. People should know that a year later, almost a year later, when the judge responsible for the case Now, it's just a couple of days back, asked for, for the conviction of a few politicians, former politicians, army reps, etc. He actually was not able to go get them because we have immunity. You know, these people have immunity because they were either part of the parliament. They are, in bed with the Sultan, with the ruling mafia. So imagine that, a year after, we need to get an immunity lifted for these people. You know, I mean, what does this mean? So in any normal country, this would have been done day one. You know, like whatever happens in this case, there is no immunity whatsoever. And whoever is convicted is going to have to go and show up in court and defend itself. I am enraged. So to be honest, I think, we suffer every day. It's not like one day after, one year later, it's not going to make a difference. If it's 1 year, if it's 6 months, it's going to be the same until we reach our objective. Until we get truth and justice for our kid.
A range of procedural flaws in the investigation, namely a lack of judicial independence, immunity for high-level officials, as Paul mentioned, and lack of respect for fair trial standards, made it impossible to deliver justice and reveal the truth. A report recently released by Human Rights Watch confirmed that many of the ones in power were criminally negligent in their handling of the ammonium nitrate upon its arrival in Beirut. Quoting the article here, government officials foresaw the death that the ammonium nitrate's presence in the port could result in and tacitly accepted the risk of the deaths occurring. Under domestic law, this could amount to the crime of homicide with probable intent. It also amounts to a violation of the right to life under the international human rights law. But will justice ever be served? Things today are a lot worse for us in Lebanon. We have no proper functioning government, and as Dr. George Kera mentioned, we're dealing with fuel shortages, leading to further electricity and generator cuts amid the intense summer heat and humidity. People line up for hours to fill up their tanks, causing massive traffic jams along the roads. Going out has become a nightmare. Personally, I don't have a car, so I rely on cabs and buses to get around, but these have become scarce and expensive. The fuel crisis has also taken the lives of dozens of people, mainly the recent fuel tanker explosion in Akkad, which was also blamed on corruption from the Sultan. Power cuts have forced many businesses to close down until further notice and are threatening to close essential services such as hospitals. The fuel crisis has also been affecting the supply of water to households in certain areas, as there is no electricity to pump water. People are getting food poisoning because of a lack of proper refrigeration. Bread and medicines are scarce. Many can't afford the most basic necessities. And while Lebanon is sinking deeper into the abyss, the Sultan is still in power, its members bickering over the division of spoils of the political pie. This desperate situation with no end in sight has caused many like Bashir and Françoise to lose hope in the country and to seek a better future elsewhere.
I hate to say it, but there's literally no hope for a better future now. And this is what it looks like because of everything happening this day. With no electricity, no fuel, we're running out of medication, I have to, my parents have, they both have diabetes, so, it's still hard to get the medication and all that. So with all these things happening and adding up to what I've been through and what most of the Lebanese people have been through, a year onwards, I can say that I'm traveling, I'm leaving Lebanon for good. In order to make a better future for myself and just in order to, not to lay my career to rest, and so to speak, because the way I see it, if we stay here, we're slowly degrading and we're slowly going backwards.
Honestly, and from previous experiences in this country, I don't see it going anywhere. I don't see justice anywhere. It's not about the explosion. It's about everything that's happening in the country. If it's just the explosion, fine. Okay, you say it's politically connected and they don't want to talk about each other and they don't want to blame each other, but it's everything. It's the electricity, it's the currency, it's the way of life we're living now. I was living outside the country for like 12 years, working outside. And then I decided to come back because I wanted to give back to Lebanon, because I know they need people like us that have faith in this country. So I came back around 11 years ago, and I wanted my kids to be raised in the same country that I was raised in. I want them to talk the same language that I talk. I want them to have the same childhood that I had, even though I had like 3 years of war. But I wanted them to go see their grandparents, to have friends, to live where I lived. But now, I don't see that happening at all. My mother once told me that when she was my age, the same thing happened, and it's going to keep happening over and over again. It was during her childhood. She left when she was 20, and then it's me with my kids, and now we're thinking about leaving. So this is like 60 years in between. Nothing changed, and nothing will ever be good enough for us to stay in this country. With this explosion, with the current situation, they took us back like 100 years, not 10 years, 100 years back. It's just a matter of time before anyone that can leave will actually leave.
Bashir and Françoise are not alone. Thousands have been applying for emigration this past year alone, many of them doctors, nurses, engineers, academics, and entrepreneurs. The World Bank warned that brain drain, mainly fueled by desperation, may have a lasting impact on the country. Stephanie Yacoub, the heroic doctor who delivered babies George and John on the day of the explosion, is one of those leaving. But like many I spoke to, she hopes to return one day, if the situation ever improves.
I've just graduated as an obstetrician gynecologist. I definitely cannot open a clinic up in Lebanon right now, just considering the economic situation. So I've been accepted to Paris to go and continue my training there. I do want to come back to Lebanon at some point and live here and work, because I really do love this country. I feel like Lebanon has always been described as a tap but never a sink. So there is an amazing amount of talent in whichever field you want to say, but everyone tends to leave and no one helps this country. So I do want to come back, if it's not made completely impossible to come back by powers that unfortunately I feel like we can't control, but they should be controlled.
But luckily for Lebanon, perhaps, not everyone wants to leave. They're definitely a minority, but I've spoken to some who still have hope and who wish to stay and keep up the fight.
So I was never optimistic until October 2019. When the revolution started, this is when I became optimistic and I decided never to leave. I hope they will let us stay as long as possible. But the thing is, up until 2019, corruption was something acceptable everywhere. You would find corrupt people in big salons and big dinners, and they would parade with their stolen money and stolen funds, and they had nice apartments in Paris, and their kids were everywhere, and corruption was okay. So I did not want to raise my daughter in this environment, and I was ready to pack up and leave any day. But then when the revolution happened, and people started finally saying the names of the corrupt and shaming them publicly and saying, you have to return the stolen money, and it's not okay to steal and to take commissions and to bribe and to steal public property, this is when I said, that's it. It has finally started. And this is why I'm so optimistic, and this is why I know that good things are coming, because change is coming grassroots. It's starting from the bottom. And this is why we're winning the syndicates, by the way, because everything is starting from underneath the first layer of corruption, even underneath it. It's from the roots up. And this is how it should have been from the start. So for me today, for example, not having any foreign currency enabling us to import food from abroad, well, fine. You have to go back and plant. Lebanon has 74% of arable land. Why are we only planting 24% of the land? And why are we importing 80%? It's because decisions, wrong decisions, were made in the 90s, removing the subsidies from agriculture, killing the industry. So now things are going back to the way they should have been from the start. So we're learning to become citizens, and it's going to take time. We're all suffering, but at the end of the day, we're going to get there. And the result is going to be absolutely fantastic, because you should always remember that our country is what we make out of it. We don't inherit it. It's what we make out of it.
From the beginning of the revolution, I used to see, I mean, like my son was there and his friends. It used to bring me joy to see them. They used to give me hope. They used to tell me, thank you. They shouldn't thank me. I should thank them. You know, with the war before, with the warlords, we did this to them. I feel guilty. I need to be with them. And when they see me, they start saying, hi, mama. We miss you. We love you. It's a responsibility for me, but I need to be there for them. I cannot leave them. You can't erase 40 years of mafia with this government. It's going to take a lot of time to change. But slowly, we are changing. You know, my generation, I think, should be thanking this young generation. I'm so proud of you. You give me hope, and you're going to be the future for this country.
Like, even my son today is angry. He's angry at the leaders of this country. He's angry at the country itself. And he tells me he wants to leave. He doesn't want to live here anymore. He wants to take his grandpa and grandma with him so we can live somewhere else. And I always try to, I feel myself trying to pull him back, like, no, mom, we still have a way to go. Just hold on a bit longer. And it's only because I really see potential in this country, and I'm really attached to it. And I want him to see the side of Lebanon that he's not living today without electricity and internet and clean water and a safe environment. You see around, we are in a daily deep depression. And every day we wake up, there's something new that rises to the surface. There's a new struggle. There's a new barrier. I understand. I'm living it myself. I mean, I go on downs that are very heavy. But when I engage with opposition groups, when I try to visit areas outside of Beirut where people actually think of change as their only opportunity to grow, and that people that don't have even the option of leaving the country, I see hope. I mean, I see hope. It's going to take time, and it's a marathon. It's not a race. We have to be patient. We need every single brain, hands, a mind, effort, energy in the opposition, working together.
We are pushing everyone to open, to stay, to rebuild. Not a single help from the government. We don't want their help. They are irresponsible, arrogant. I pity them. Maybe they have money, but they will never be happy inside. The anger and the hatred of the people cannot let them live calmly and happily. After 1 year, the whole team is still here, except the one who left the country. We rebuilt Mayrik. We rebuilt the houses of all the employees. We are still going through hospitalization. We are still have a lot of operation for the eyes to go through. But the team is together. We created other concepts for deliveries. We created job opportunities. We're not letting go, not only because we believe in the country, not only because we are part of this country. We have a team. We have 19 years of story. We have a team that lost senses. And no way I will turn my back on my people. No way I will give up. I'm so lucky that I didn't lose anyone, and I will give back anything to bring these people together and to show them that this is the Lebanon that we believe in.
August 21st, 2021. I'm not sure how to end the story, as there is no end to it yet. As I mentioned earlier, things are getting worse every passing day, and it's hard to see the light at the end of the tunnel. Many have given up on the country, but for those of us who are staying, hope is the only thing we have left. Someday we might build a decent country with a proper government which will grant us the most basic rights we deserve. Better yet, A country which will provide us with many opportunities to thrive, somewhere we can have a future. A country we will never want to leave. And maybe someday we'll be able to write a happy ending.
Time does make things better, actually. I think the first reason is that, you know, you have a routine that is very hard at the beginning. You're used to wake up and, you know, taking care of Lixu. We have our, you know, the routine, the life with her. And a year later, I had the fear that how will life continue? How are we going to do? And a year later, you see that actually with, you know, a bit of strength, a bit of courage, the love that we have as a couple, that, you know, we actually managed to continue life, to install a new routine, a new life as, you know, as a married couple. And so, no, things are not getting harder. Yes, we miss her. Yes, we are still very sad. I wake up every morning, I cry for, you know, I cry. But, you know, I think we are getting stronger, and we got stronger. Yeah. We are getting stronger every day. And you just learn to see that, you know, that there's still life. We still have a future. There is actually, you know, beautiful things in life that we still have to make to see that we'll be able someday to, you know, rebuild a family with sisters and brothers for Lixu. This is going to take time because it's difficult, but, you know, we're trying to reach, enfin, to get to this point.
I am hopeful because the day after the blast and the days after the blast, the months, it was the people that rebuilt it and it was the people that cleaned it up. Not one politician or anyone came to do anything. But just knowing that despite everything, we cleaned each other's homes and we cleaned each other's wounds and we've been there to support one another lets you know that there's no country that can crash knowing that the people are like that. I can't just give up and say, yep, that's it. Can't give up on your home. It's been home for way too long.
Our hearts go out to everyone who's lost their loved ones, their homes, to everyone who was forced to leave their country behind to build a better future for themselves. Thank you for listening to our story. Don't hesitate to share this podcast if it has moved you in any way. We need the world to hear about our fight for justice. Beirut Blast is a Rising Giants Network production. Written and narrated by myself, Linda Tamim. Mixing and sound designed by Bashar Najjar and Saad Kiswani. Beirut Blast is available on Apple Podcast, Anghami, Spotify, Deezer, Podio, or wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe and rate Beirut Blast on your favorite podcast app.